Executive Director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And before we begin the presentation today, I'd just like to take a moment to acknowledge all of the folks that are volunteering their time to be here this weekend. It seems like the coolest thing in the world to get to go to a comic book show for free, and it's pretty cool, I'm not going to lie about that. However, these folks are working really hard to ensure that you, me, and everybody here has a great experience, so I'd just like to give them all a round of applause. Thank you. Here's to the minions. This morning, we are going to be talking about Tales from the Code, True Tales of Comic Book Censorship, about the period between 1954 and 2011 that the code existed, but we're going to be focusing specifically on the era of the 70s and the 80s, after the changes in 1971 that were brought by the code, and as the code eventually wound itself down towards the end of the 20th century. I'm pleased to be joined today by Jim Starlin. Thank you for coming out. Jim, when I was growing up and reading your work, I was amazed at how you introduced me to the concepts of psychedelia in the context of these comics that are going out into mainstream comics. And as I got older and dug much more deeply into life and the material, I just saw how deeply coded the life experience and the mysticism was in a lot of that work. How in the world did
somebody
you get this mind bending?
How
did you get this mind bending stuff through in the first place?
I was working at Marvel. Roy Thomas had become the editor, and the line had gone from 6 books a month to something like 20, which is why I got a job in the first place, because they were hiring anybody who came across the state line that could hold a pencil. Roy was always cool to work with. I just had to come in and say, this issue's got the super scrawl in it, and he would let me off to go wherever I wanted with it. So the content was just things that were popping up in my head as we were going along. Did mostly bi-monthly books, so I had 2 months to play around with the thing. And it was just whatever came to mind, I would sneak in there, and sometimes the code would come after me, and sometimes it wouldn't. Most of the time it wouldn't, but the first year that Warlock was out, the code gave out entirely 8 different violations that they said things had to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
3 of them were for Warlock. Mm-hmm. The entire industry, the rest of it got 5, I got 3.
Let's back up a little bit and just contextualize the comics code. In the 1940s and early 1950s, there was a real spread of moral panic about comics in the United States, and it kind of reached a culmination point. It absolutely reached a culmination point with the publication of the book The Seduction of the Innocent, which I'm sure everybody here has heard of in some capacity. It was written by this fellow that you see on the right of your screen named Dr. Frederick Wortham, who had done a lot of really great pioneering work for the socially disadvantaged, the economically disadvantaged, the mentally ill, but also was such a publicity hound and so enmeshed in his own research being propelled, that he created this book of junk science that has not only been proved to be junk science without a control group, but actually falsified information, which we just learned last year. At the time, however, he was the good doctor working with these at-risk kids at the Lafarge Clinic, and he was convinced that comics would turn good kids into juvenile delinquents. And so this led to the U.S. government having a subcommittee hearing about comics and juvenile delinquency 60 years ago, April and August of 1954, where they investigated whether comics were a contributing factor to this rise. And so Wortham went on the stand and said that the normal child is the one who is most likely to be harmed and damaged by comics. And quite frankly, gentlemen, the Nazis had nothing on the comic book industry when it comes to warping young children. And so in this context, it was a really powerful televised spectacle, and a lot of people gave careful credence to what he had to say. At the same time, Bill Gaines, who was the publisher of EC Comics, volunteered to take the stand, which is probably the greatest misjudgment in the history of comics,
exactly,
which is a kind way of putting it. And Gaines was a 33-year-old guy who had inherited this comic book company he didn't want, and ultimately found a path through creating titles like Tales from the Crypt and Shock Suspense Stories and others to go, hey, this is pretty cool, I love doing this. And so when comics were being put on TV as this scourge against youth, he was really upset because he and his colleagues poured their hearts and souls into this, and so he was convinced that if I just go up there and tell them the truth about why we're doing this, then everything's going to be okay. And so for weeks going into the hearing, he was preparing his statements and staying up all night, and he had a weight problem and was taking diet pills, which we would now refer to as speed. And so staying up for weeks, you know, popping these pills, working with Lyle Stewart in the wee hours of the night, who was one of his partners, he came up with this testimony that no kid has ever been harmed by a comic book. And it was good, defiant stuff. If you read the copy, it's very cogent, and it's more relevant than ever today. But at the time, it hit the wrong note. At the time, it was also following him saying that, you putting out an ad that was called Are You a Red Duke, where it said that the group most anxious to destroy comics are the communists, which was not received well by the senators of the era. And so they backed him into a corner and put up the cover of Crime Suspense Stories and said, you know, do you think that this cover is in good taste? And Gaines famously said, yes, sir, I do, for the cover of a horror comic, which is like the worst pull quote in the history of comics, because the next day the New York Times ran a headline that said no harm in horror comics issuer said. The following week, Newsweek ran an editorial saying that if the only law of this content that our children are reading is the morality of these ne'er-do-wells, then this is a lawless industry that needs to be cleaned up. And so there was a very strong and pervasive fear that was real in the comics industry that we either have to police ourselves, or the government's going to police us, or we're going to be out of business. And
you
so
you had the wrong cover there for the thing. The one that the Jack Davis cover that they had was a close-up of a head, a severed head that is being held.
That's a severed head.
Yes, but it had a banner at the bottom of it that covered the bottom of the neck.
Ah.
And they said to Gaines, you know, this is really tasteless. How can you defend this? And he pulled off the banner at the bottom to show them the bottom of the neck that had the blood dripping out of it and said, we could have run this instead.
In either case, like, it's not the right testimony.
No.
You know, and
famously so.
Famously so. And so, you know, Gaines, when the code went through, you know, pulled out, and this is him at the press conference, you know, ripping up his publications and saying, we're going to sin no more. But ultimately, the code that was passed in 1954 really altered comics in a way that brought them down to a level where previously they had spoken to a broad range of audiences, you know, including children, absolutely. But also, you know, servicemen that had come back from World War II. A full quarter of the printed matter that went to PXs was comic books, and those people were coming back and reading something, and it stands to reason that they were reading the comics that Charlie Biro was putting out with Crime Does Not Pay and that Bill Gaines was putting out. The code came in and put paid to all of it, saying that you know, crime is never going to be presented in a way to create sympathy for the criminal. Policemen, judges, government officials, and institutions shall never be presented as a way to create disrespect. In every instance, good shall triumph over evil. You can read the full copy and the full text on cbldf.org, because I don't want to take time away from the discussion here today. But there are also some bits of, you know, business advantage here too. No comic magazine shall have the word horror or terror in its title.
Or zombie.
Or zombie. Zombies could not be used. Vampirism could not be used. You know, gruesome materials should be eliminated. And so, almost literally overnight, comics went from being this diverse thing to being this very sanitized thing for, you know, either children or half-wits or half-witted children, but certainly not anything that any respectable individual is going to read.
That's when I started reading them.
So here's some illustrations of how the code altered comics. So the lighting isn't very good in here, but, you know, you've got this War of the Worlds sort of story on the left side. Just look at that top left panel. The guy's eyes are bugged out. Now compare the counterpoint. His eyes are half-lidded and dim. The code prohibited anything that would elicit any kind of excitement, any kind of depiction of horror. The alien who's coming and invading the Earth is this strange three-eyed creature, and on the right he's just a dude with an unfortunately large head. You know, as we go deeper into the story, the man finds the only way to escape this menace of these alien invaders is to to kill his wife and himself and just, you know, take their own lives rather than be taken over. And on the right-hand side, they pack their bags and leave town because I guess the aliens don't have advanced technology to find them. Here is how they would handle the actual art boards. They, before the age of cheap xerography, they would just go on and actually white out the material right on the board. So here, the frantic scream of a dying man becomes the frantic scream of a dude being punched in the chest. Or here is one that the cleavage on the evening dress is just far too shocking for the sensibility of audiences in the 1950s. And so this was the law of the land. Please.
They also, at that, when they first started off, they eliminated some really absurd things that you could draw in the comic books. You couldn't do rocket ships because they looked like phallic symbols. You couldn't do winged creatures because it was supposed to be mocking the angels. So the original folks who took over on the Comics Code really had some heavy-duty suppression going on there.
So, Jim, you were saying that you started reading comics in the period where the Code started to come down. Did you start strictly after, or did you start before? Like, did you see a change in the content in your early reading of comics?
Started in the 50s. They were all very sterile. But at the same time, I was going around on my bicycle to these little secondhand shops. Mm-hmm. And so I was picking up a lot of comics from the earlier periods. You know, I was getting early Captain Marvels in 1950, Captain Americas for a nickel apiece. So I had sort of a broader range of things. Superman and Batman had been reduced to Batman with the giant typewriters and Superman with the different types of kryptonite that had turned him onto something interesting in that cover. It was pretty bland. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so what alerted you that, you know, there could be more to comics than Beppo the Super Monkey?
The next 20 years. You know, I mean, Marvel came along. I mean, DC had its first revival somewhere in the 60s, bring back Flash, Green Lantern. They were pretty sanitized. I mean, that's why they have trouble making movies of those particular characters, because they don't have a lot going on personality-wise. Then Marvel came along, and it expanded. You know, Jack and Stan and Steve all expanded what they were doing tremendously. And, you know, it just, I came into the business, worked with other artists, learned different things. The Code slowly disappeared. You know, I only had a little bit of trouble with it at the beginning.
When did you start working professionally?
About 71.
Okay.
So, around 73 is when they hit me with a number of violations. Within a year or so, this comic came out, and the Code was pretty much off the books at that point.
Right. 71 was an important year because that was when, informed by a variety of things, right? Because the Code was a creature of business utility. The Code was about the ability to distribute your comics on newsstands, and the culture had completely changed between 1954 when it was passed and 1971. You know, you have the entire Vietnam conflict, you have the entire counterculture of the mid-60s through the early 70s, and so comic books were changing to adapt to that environment. And in 1971, the Nixon administration asked Marvel to create a comic book addressing the ill effects of drug use. And so they had run this story famously in Spider-Man number 96 that was a, you know, propaganda piece about how evil drugs are and don't use them, kids. And so the Code, as written in 54 and still governing comics in 71, prohibited any mention of drug use, you know, let alone, you know, this cautionary tale here. And so there was a bit of a conundrum about this because Marvel did the issue. They were asked by the government, and also it sounded like good sales. And they sent it to the Code, and the final arbiter that had to make the decision about putting the seal on the book or not was out on vacation. And so in, you know, classic Stan Lee fashion, it was, well, to hell with it. We're going to put it out without the Code seal. Now, experts I've spoken to since have said, no, the book would have gone out either way. But the important thing, like, the Code would have put the seal on there either way. But the important thing is that they didn't have time to wait. They put the book out without the seal, and sales weren't affected. There was no difference in distribution. And so this led to the code being revised in 1971 when Jim actually got into the field here. And so you saw a loosening. So the restriction on the words horror or terror in a title were removed. The
we stopped having to spell zombies Z-U-M-B-Y.
Yeah, exactly. The issue of werewolves, you know, they were allowed back in. And Mark Wolfman tells a funny story that the reason that the credits, he claims, were let back into the comics is because he was writing a story for House of Secrets, and the narrator said, "This next story was told to me by a wandering wolfman," and the code censor said, "You can't mention werewolves." And he goes, "The kid's name is Marv Wolfman." He goes, "Well, you got to put the name, the credit in, that the writer's name is Wolfman, or we're not going to let it through." And so that's how that worked. Got back in, according to Marv. But classic horror traditions were allowed back into the comics, but they also revised the way drugs and narcotics could be depicted. And this set the stage for the relevant comics movement, which a lot of this stuff looks campy now, but at the time, you know, nothing like it had been done. And so, Jim, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the climate of being a professional at the time of these changes and what you and your peers were, you know, thinking about in terms of what you were able to express within the context of comics, you know, thanks to these changes.
Well, at that point, most of the cartoonists who had been drawing comics since World War II were beginning to retire. And around 71, there was a whole load of us who came in, young guys who wanted to draw comics, and like I said, we could hold a pencil. So we were also, because we were young, there was a little bit of drug use going on there. And I remember when Stan's Spider-Man came out, it was all around the office, and everybody was getting a kick out of it because Stan was writing the first drug comic book, didn't have a clue. He had no idea what anything was. And as I recall, they're popping pills or something in it.
Something silly.
It's something that, you know, wasn't what was going on at the time. But everybody got a kick out of that. Later on, when you had this one come up, Denny and Neil sort of kicked everybody in the ass by doing something that no one was figuring was going to happen, turning Speedy into a junkie. Denny and Neil actually knew what the works looked like and that, so they threw it down there right on the cover, which you couldn't do on television even today, I don't think. So they were a big change. It was just something that had never happened before.
Was there any sense of creative challenge or one-upsmanship in this? Like, hey, that guy pushed us there, so I can push us here?
Not particularly. Denny and Neil were doing something entirely on their own. I mean, it did affect stories other places, but like myself, I was doing cosmic stories, so the drug use in that didn't have anything to do with my plots. Mm-hmm. So I would say that in my case, it's probably not, but other than I admire Neil's work so much, other companies did similar stories. I don't think any of them did it as well as Denny and Neil did, but there was no particular come up in the ship on that particular front. On a lot of other fronts, there would be, but not that particular territory.
Like what? What other fronts was there that?
Who gets better sales, who gets more awards, who gets more fans at the table, that sort of thing. You know, the regular ego things that you get to this day.
Yeah, the regular ego things, but also, you know, that you're altering the content to an audience that's becoming more sophisticated. You know, and you're also, you know, you're altering, this was the generation where the fans actually began to generate their own stories, and we began to build the infrastructure of modern comics. So, you know, what was the condition of speaking to that changing audience like before the direct market?
Well, it was beginning to change with the influx of all these new people anyhow, because they wanted to do their kind of tough comic books and not the type that had been going on before. Even the old pros like Jack Kirby, along during this period, their creativity just exploded. Jack suddenly went from Thor taking on Mr. Hyde and the Cobra to going out into outer space and confronting Galactus and Ergo, the living planet, and all these other things that you couldn't do anywhere else at that time, but in a comic. Mm-hmm. No television or movie could actually match up with what he was doing at that point. So the change was happening on a lot of different levels. This was just part of the overall transformation the comic book industry was going into. It was just people wanted to come in there and do art, not just commerce.
Let's pull back to the code briefly, and you had mentioned that Warlock was, you know, had three of the eight pieces of censorship that occurred.
I'm proud of that year.
You should be. That's, you know. So talk to me about what the process was. So you'd finish your pages, and then what?
They would go off to, you know, they'd send off a set of Xeroxes, black and white Xeroxes to the code. They would say, this was wrong, that was wrong. In the first issue of Warlock, we had some guy getting boiled in oil. The church was boiling somebody in oil. They thought that was wrong. And so we changed it into black and white artwork, but they never changed it into color. So if you look closely at the first printing of Warlock, there's a guy being boiled in oil in color, and I think he's just upside down, or they moved it around, but you could see both images, one in black and white and one in color. So it wasn't like a really foolproof process, but, you know, by the time I came around, they weren't doing it as often. There was no ramifications to it. Nobody said, bad boy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they just said, hey, you got sighted again. And it was actually sort of a badge of honor, I guess, at the time, and especially among the cartoonists. The editors, they just didn't care because they were so busy.
Right.
You know, the editor, let's put that way. That was Roy. So they would change it, and it would go out, and that was about the extent of the entire process.
And so what were, so the boiled in oil was one. What were some of the other instances where your content was asked to be changed or demanded to be changed?
Oh, I remember. The second one was I did, in the first issue, a bunch of little imp demons, and none of them had pants on. And at that point, Marvel was trying to save money, so they would reprint a couple of the pages from the previous issue's recap, where you were supposed to do a page sideways, and they would do it as a spread. And what I did was Xerox the same stories, and all the imps that had their bare bottoms running around, they had to put pants on in the second issue, even though they had missed it in the first issue. And I've forgotten what the third one was. It was something really minor. These are the two that we had launched.
Mm-hmm. And so through the 70s, there was, it's interesting you mentioned the technical issue, because, you know, that's something that, like, one of the stories that Frank Miller's proud of telling is that he had blood everywhere, and they said, you can't have this much blood, but he figured out that if he did a color hold and printed red but showed black, they didn't know what to do with it. You know, there's a lot of just kind of figuring out the printing technology, it seems, to figure out, you know, how to get your stories through as well. And so, you know, how did that influence, you know, as an artist crafting images, you know, understanding what was going to be happening on the presses in terms of how you were going to be telling your stories?
Well, we were always experimenting along those lines, more so to see what we could actually accomplish. I remember Frank Miller Xeroxing a bunch of stills from Casablanca or something and throwing it up on the screen, and none of us were sure that was going to print or not. Mm-hmm. It may have just come out of these black blobs. As it happened, it worked out fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
Getting around the code was really not much of anybody's worry. I mean, mm-hmm. we just figured it was either going to happen or not happen. And by the time I came along, they had been lax enough that they weren't the problem that they were in the 50s.
Right. Right.
Long shot, you know. So the code itself was never my nemesis. My nemesis was always the editors. I always had more trouble with them than the code.
Why is that?
Sometimes they would try and pull you back. I remember when I did The Death of Captain Marvel, it almost didn't get used because most of the editors up there hated the idea of him dying of cancer. And it was only Jim Shooter who said that, no, this is terrific, use it.
Right.
But every other editor up there, and there was like six of them at that point, said, this is terrible.
Right.
And if it hadn't been Shooter, I wouldn't have gotten it through.
And that brings up a really interesting juncture in comics history as well, because as the direct-to-fan, by-fan, for-fan environment of the comic book convention and the comic book store, most particularly, came about. It created the mechanism where something like the Marvel graphic novel could come to be. So how did that creative opportunity come to you? How did, you know, you were one of the first, were you the first one?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were the guy that was like, if this is going to work, then we'll take credit for it, but if it's not going to work, it's Jim's fault. So how did that happen?
Well, that's real common in the comics. Yeah. If it works out, it's, yeah, we won't go there because Denny is part of that story. They decided they were just not going to have any code on these because they had already, it was already fading away. Archie Goodwin was responsible for the line of comics called Epics, which is where I did Dreadstar to begin with. And because of Archie was the best editor I ever worked with. And because of his ability to look beyond, you know, just trying to protect his job, he let me do whatever I wanted, and I was able to do a storyline about one of the characters who was a survivor of incest, which I would have never gotten anywhere near back in the old days.
Right.
2 years before, I couldn't have done that story. You know, it just, there are things that you can do. I know a lot of times when you get the freedom, a lot of really crazy stuff comes down, a lot of it insulting, bad, but then 99% of most stuff is garbage to begin with. It's the good stuff that you remember. You forget about brother geeks and stuff like that. And that just gave us a chance to go off and do some other stories. I think the death of Captain Marvel was also along those lines. Editors would have been conditioned not to be able to pull that off. In fact, this is when Milgram got his job as an editor. They brought him in so that he could be my editor on that book. So, you know, there's a lot of resistance in some of the older editors than it was to what was going on actually in the business. Mm-hmm. And the code wasn't as big a thing, big problem as just the fear of what the code might do.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And so the code really diminished throughout the 1980s, again, as a creature of commerce, the newsstand just became less important, and the comic book store became more important. And so the Marvel graphic novel was one piece of this, but you started to see more and more material go out into the channel that didn't need the seal of approval. So you had, you'd mentioned Archie's Epic publications, which then became a line. DC started to do things like they ran Swamp Thing without the code as their first title to go out. That was a main, you know, one of their marks, one of their trademark characters, you know, without the seal. And it opened up just these huge new vistas of storytelling. And that seems like it must have been a pretty exciting time to be working. You know, you certainly spread your wings in a variety of both, you know, creator-owned and company-owned directions in the 1980s. And so can you contrast a bit how the freedom of expression for you, you know, altered over the course of that span, in contrast with, you know, what things were like in the 70s.
There's always conflict in any kind of endeavor. I mean, people are going to butt heads. The code disappeared, but we still had imposed censorship brought in, and during the 80s and 90s, it became from the comic book distributors and comic book shops. They had a big one. There was a guy down in Texas named Buddy Sanders. And he became, I think Marvel folded on some demand that he wanted. He became, it went to his head, and he became the arbiter of good taste in comics and was constantly trying to get comics pulled or wouldn't run them in his stores, which he had like about three of them down in Texas. And they occasionally paid attention to him. So he became the new Frederick Wortham, much minor, much smaller than what the 1950s chaos was about. But to this day, you still get, you know, Christian groups who will call in and say, this is terrible. I guess there was some big flap about some Spider-Woman covers the last few weeks. They got a pinup artist to do some Spider-Woman covers, and they got blasted for being sexist. There's always going to be somebody out there who's offended. I think that's a pretty good thing. It shows you're actually doing something. if you're making people think in any way, I think that's a good thing, even if it's just to get them irate for a while. Now, it gets the gray matter working, but, you know, it's always going to be a balancing act. There's always going to be somebody who's going to be offended.
And have you had to manage that in your own creativity, any kind of moral outrage about the content of your work that you've had to speak up about?
No, most of the time I don't speak up about it. Most of the time it's stuff that just strikes me as bizarre. I was doing Batman, and I had this one story where there was a serial killer. He was dumping women in a dumpster. He was narrating the story. It was his thoughts that were going through the story. And when he gets caught at one point, he says, well, I'll get myself a smart Jew lawyer and I'll get out of this. You know, and this was not anybody I was laying out there as a role model. This was supposed to be a bad guy. And when he said that, I never gave it two thoughts that anyone would get upset about it. I was wrong. I got a lot of grief on that particular one.
And so, you know, what was your process of dealing with those complaints? Did you, you know, simply shrug and say the work speaks for itself?
No, I didn't comment usually at all. Mm-hmm. I just go on to the next job. Most of the time, you know, there's some nervous editor who's calling me up to inform me of this stuff because mm-hmm. I don't go up into the offices all that time.
So what's your advice to a creator today that turns in a job that gets run, that gets maligned on the internet for various reasons?
Well, it's getting maligned on the internet, no matter how good it is. Maligned on the internet. There's a whole crew of folks out there that do nothing but that. I had this book just come out recently, and I was kind of surprised how many good reviews I was getting on it. And hey, that's pretty cool. And sure enough, last week, finally, some guy just ripped it to pieces. I knew he was going to show up eventually. Mm-hmm. So you don't pay any attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do, you get yourself crazy.
Right. Right. As the 80s progressed, the code underwent its final set of revisions in 1989. With a far less restrictive, almost conversational set of guidelines that were, you know, kind of bullet-pointed overall guidance. So it went from being this very legalistic, thou shalt not set of guidelines to things like costumes in a comic book will be considered to be acceptable if they fall within the scope of contemporary styles and fashions. And this was written about the time that Madonna published her steel-covered sex book. So, you know, that being a bestseller, what are, you know, contemporary styles and fashions? And so if you look at comics, you know, in the 90s, a lot of it was informed, you know, by the fact that, you know, this mechanism is no longer as important, you know, to our style of story. Over the time to come, the publishers continued to pay into the Comic Magazine Association of America that administrated the code, and they continued to go to meetings every year to, you know, let it be the one place that competitors could come together and chat about what's going on without, you know, running afoul of various laws. But the code, you know, became less important as an actual censorship mechanism. It was just this kind of, you know, lingering business mechanism. And in 2001, Bill Gemmis, who was then the head of Marvel Comics on the publishing side, very famously in his signature attention-grabbing style, pulled out of the code and said, if you've got to pay somebody to put a seal on the book that says it's okay, that, you know, there's something wrong with that system. That's just BS. And so he, you know, made that statement, and he also made a bunch of insulting remarks about specific people working in this competitor and, you know, stopped paying into the code, and it was a thing that allowed others to follow suit. So quietly and without maligning their competitors, folks like Bongo and Image and others pulled out of participation with this body. And so at the very end, in 2011, the only people that were left were Archie Comics and DC Comics. And
the only reason Archie was doing it because the heads of the Comic Code were all the publishers of Archie.
Yes, exactly. And so, but even Archie at the very end admitted that the books are going out without the seal. They weren't actually sending them to White Plains to get rated. You know, it was an automatic thing. And so in early 2011, like February of that year, I got a phone call from a lawyer at DC Comics saying, all right, so I'm going to get rid of the code. It's not doing its job, nobody wants it, and it's not important anymore. But for 60 years, this thing has been a symbol of censorship. And so we are going to assign the intellectual property rights to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and we want you guys to use the code to fight censorship, you know, in the future. And so the fund inherited the seal. And, you know, yes, we do use it for modest fundraising purposes, but much more importantly, it's important to look at the code as a moment in history where popular culture was hobbled by moral panic. And you would like to think that this could never happen again. But free expression is a cyclical process of, in the 1970s, everything was permitted, in the 1990s, everything was scary. You know, and this just continues to happen. In the 1950s, comics were the great evil that were going to turn children into delinquents. And in the 1980s, when I was listening to Slayer, heavy metal was the thing that was going to turn young kids into, you know, bloodthirsty child killers. And instead, it turned us into free speech advocates, which might be worse. You know, and now it's the video games that are going to, you know, turn kids, you know, good kids bad. And, you know, the thing is, if you look back across time, you know, first of all, the younger generation always finds a way to horrify their elders. That's their job. And, you know, your elders, you know, and it's going to happen to you too. It's going to happen someday. Enjoy it now. And when you are horrified by something that your kid or your niece or your nephew brings home and you go, how can you possibly be reading this thing about, you know, God only knows what's going to offend people in 20 years, but it's going to happen. You're presented with a choice. You know, do I take it away? Do I go and try to get it banned, you know, in the general, you know, sphere? Or do I have a conversation going, do you really need to listen to a song called Angel of Death about the Holocaust? Do you know what the Holocaust is, you dumb kid? You know, it's like, well, no, but I know what Tom Araya's lick is, and it sounds awesome. Like, you know, this is the point of, you know, having this dialogue between the generations. And right now, there's a great deal of censorship actually happening about comics. The end of September every year marks Banned Books Week, which is the annual celebration of the freedom to read. And if you go to our booth at 2501, you can have some free resources about the books that are being challenged. And we're talking about books like Bone, which has been challenged and banned in states all over the country, but, you know, most especially Texas and Missouri. Alleging that the depiction of adults smoking and drinking beer in taverns is unacceptable in those communities, because I guess adults don't do that.
Especially in Texas.
To even stranger things, like, you know, Bone promotes racism. I don't know where they read. I don't know what book they read. You know, Bone creates an unhealthy view of sexuality because you have this non-human creature mating with, you know, this lady, even though that's not what's going on. The censors have their reading comprehension issues, but they have a right to speak out for what they believe, and it's our right to also say this material is protected. Other books that have been challenged frequently include Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi, which was banned in the Chicago public schools, or attempted to be banned in the Chicago public schools last year. My understanding, there's a local controversy brewing here in Maryland regarding this that we're starting to investigate. You know, you can read all of this stuff online. I don't, you know, want to take away time from talking to, you know, one of our legends here. But it is still happening, and it can still happen again. And so the fund inheriting the code seal is really about, this is a thing that happened that hurt the industry and placed hundreds of creative people out of work, and there will always be moral panic, and there will always be censorship scares, and so how do we cope with it? And that is really the important lesson, you know, moving forward. And, you know, while I was speaking about Bill Gaines in a fashion that some might not have regarded as, you know, extraordinarily charitable, but it was true, you know, it really did happen. You know, in the end, if you read his testimony, you know, perhaps he was right. He said, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid of our own children? Do we forget that they are citizens too and entitled to select what to read or do? The basic personality of a child is established before he reaches the age of comic book reading. The truth is that delinquency is a product of real environment in which the child lives and not of the fiction he reads. There are many problems that reach our children today. No pill can cure them. No law will legislate them out of being. The problems are economic and social, and they are complex. Our people need understanding. They need to have affection, decent homes, and decent food. I can never remember having seen one boy or girl who has committed a crime or who became neurotic or psychotic because he or she read comic books. The condition in which he read that statement was not optimal. But the words ring true, and perhaps even more true today, as we confront serious social issues that can be easily blamed on video games but have much deeper roots than that, or as we try to ban comics that depict nudity or sexuality at the same time as we have serious cultural changes and variables that are affecting the health and safety of our young people just walking around in their pockets on their cell phones. And so dialogue is always what we advocate in protecting free speech, and the code is a clear illustration of one of the worst case scenarios that can happen. At that, we've got about 10 minutes for Q&A out there. Feel free to ask us about anything, including any of Jim's career stuff that you're curious about. Yep.
Well, I actually work in college, and I spend a lot of time helping parents of select age-appropriate things. I spend a lot of time saying, you know, comics aren't just for kids. You know, Alan Moore stuff is great, and on and on. But comics should be for kids, too. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious, Mr. Scarlett, do you like the, you know, T for teen, E for everyone, the new kind of rating system that's kind of placed the code? Or, you know, do you think there's a need for any kind of code at all? Or?
I didn't know there was a rating system, to tell you the truth. You know, I think the content, you just have to sort of look through a book and you can tell who it's appropriate for. I don't think that you need a guide that gives you these different ratings. The book company, Time Warner, in particular, was always very against there being any kind of comic book rating. The book company, not the comic book company, DC. DC was actually going to do a rating system. Somewhere in the 80s, I think it was, and Time Warner Books said, no, you're not. And they went to the parent company, and that was the end of that. I think it's, you know, if you're a young kid, you're not going to be attracted to the horror stuff. Ron Mars was up here on this table with me yesterday telling me how he, when he was 5 years old, he found a bunch of Jack Kirby comic books, and all those square fingers and that scared the hell out of him. And so he didn't go back to it for like another 10 years or something like that. I don't think that, you know, if you're too young or something, you're going to not be attracted to the thing that's going to horrify you unless you're ready for it. I used to go to the Saturday afternoon matinees they used to have back in the 50s, which were nothing but monster movie fests. If anyone in my age group should have gone off and become a chicken slayer or something like that, it probably should have been me. I didn't do that. I don't think anybody other than somebody who's got some serious problems to begin with. And there are probably a lot of warning signals that nobody's seen. I do have one story I'd like to share on censorship that just happened recently. I was working on this Thanos book that's just come out, and there was a character in it that was smoking some kind of narcotic. And they had trouble with it up at the office, and they said, we got to change this. And Tom Brevoort, of all people, came up with the solution. Instead of smoke coming out of the pipe, he had bubbles coming out. And I thought that was just great. Yeah. Any other questions?
Was there anything that you put into, like, in addition to a comic that you never thought would get through the code, and they ended up publishing anyway, or any cases that you know of that?
I can't think of anything that I would have put down that I would have thought wasn't going to make it through. I was always surprised when somebody threw up a white flag. So no, I'd have to say no on that.
Other questions out there? I'd like to address the gentleman's point, too, about guidance for parents in this area, guidance for kids. First of all, we create resources. If you check out our table, we've got a free publication called Raising a Reader, How Comics and Graphic Novels Can Help Your Kids Love to Read, that you should take a few back to your store to just hand out to parents to use. But, you know, to Jim's point, kids are usually their own best censors, and they know what they're ready for. That doesn't mean parents shouldn't be involved, because they may not know how to process what they're ready for, but they know that they're ready to access it. You know, one of the problems that happens, you know, repeatedly is that
parents aren't really ready to have the conversation about what their kids are ready for. And, you know, no fault of that. I mean, nobody over 25 has any idea what it's like to be under 25 right now. The variables are so completely different for anybody growing up that's a digital native and that's growing up in this media environment. And that makes it all the more important to create this feeling of safety for dialogue, of accessing the materials. You know, you have a right as a parent to go, I don't want my kid reading this book, and I'm going to request an alternate assignment. You know, and then the consequences are on you to have that dialogue with your kid or not. The issue that becomes problematic is when you say, I'm not ready to have this dialogue with my kid, or I disagree morally with this content, and so I'm going to prevent other parents from accessing this material, or I'm going to go to your store and say, I don't want you selling Jim's comic with these people smoking a pipe because I don't want my kids getting the wrong
bubble
idea.
Bubble pipe.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, a lot of the challenge comes in. But in general, more speech is always better than less speech in these areas, because if you create the prohibition, to a certain degree, A, you're creating more desire for them to go find the forbidden fruit. I mean, I wasn't allowed to read comics when I was a kid, and look where I ended up. And secondly, you know, creating those opportunity for dialogue in those teachable moments are really the purpose of art. You know, it's about communication and reaching people. So, are you giving us the we have to get off the stage?
This
sign?
Means yeah. something.
No, nobody says 5 minutes anymore?
Okay,
thank you. Thank you, guys.